The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Of your texts on city centre crime, it was cringing hearing your two guests defending the lack of action by Gardaí in Dublin city centre. Over 10 years ago, my son was mugged, beaten up in town. We got a very nice letter saying we're sorry you've been the victim of a crime, but nothing happened in the meantime. It's maddening listening to those two downplaying it, says Helen in Dublin 11. How do you tackle antisocial behaviour? They won't jail somebody for peeing in a doorway, shooting up, drinking, begging. At best, it's a suspended sentence. All you can do is move them on, don't do it here, etc. We just don't enforce anything in this country, from littering to petty crime. Well said, aggressive begging here in Carrick and Shannon, especially in the summer, which frightens tourists and locals alike. That's from Johnny. The level of organised begging in Galway City is a disgrace. It lowers the tone of the street, creating an unfriendly atmosphere which adds to antisocial behaviour and so much more than that. And it's a topic we might pick up with our Friday forum, because I am joined by Catherine Murphy, Social Democrats TD for Kildare, co-leader of her party, Damien English, Fine Gael TD for Meath West, Minister of State for Business, Employment and Retail, and Lynn Ruan, Independent Trinity College Senator. Good morning and welcome to you all. Damien, first of all, we'll go to you because, you know, our listeners have been very exercised. The announcement of a Garda task force to handle this kind of thing is probably to be welcomed. But, you know, why wasn't it done years ago?
Well, look, I think from a retail point of view, when I chaired the retail forum, we want to make our town centres and our city centres a more attractive place to people to come and spend time in, because retail is more of an experience now in hospitality. And whatever can deal with giving people, you know, a better perception of our cities and towns and villages is important. So a task force is important to do that. Look, at the causes of crime and everything else, there are ongoing conversations to do with education and supports, and that's one issue. But managing our streets and our town centres are important. And if a task force can bring all the agencies together to approach this in the appropriate way to improve it, because in many cases, I sit down with groups around the country, there's a perception that's often worse than it is, but either way it needs to be dealt with, you know, whether it's real or perception. People have to feel safe and confident.
I mean, the people
streets.
On the street might not be setting out to intimidate you, but if you feel intimidated, that's damaging.
And very often they're not, but that perception does damage people's decision to come into our cities and our towns.
Yeah, look, the thing about it is that, you know, there's no doubt we need more visibility of guards on the street to deal with things that go beyond antisocial behaviour and our criminal behaviour. But I think if anyone thinks that this is going to be a solution, there's a much wider issue that needs to be dealt with here that is just beyond a policing solution that we need to deal with. And there is...
Sure, but those kind of things, they actually take time. You know, education, proper housing, maybe not having the same density of temporary people, transients running through the place, and so on and so forth. They take time to fix. In the meantime, next summer's tourists are walking down O'Connell Street and there is someone sitting under an ATM machine, which is intimidating when you're going to get cash out of a machine. Lynn?
I'm not too worried about tourists. You know, at the end of the day, when we think of this idea of aggressive begging, we have to actually ask about, you know, aggressive living, aggressive poverty, aggressive policies.
We were talking about organised begging earlier on, where the mendicant is dropped off in a van in the morning. Now, they may be trafficked, they may be unwilling kids.
But just to continue.
But it's an operation.
But at the end of the day, people don't beg if they have other options available to them. If there's other ways that people can succeed, they will choose that. People's conditions and environments create a situation where begging is what's going to be the best thing in their life to be able to give them what they need.
But if you can't escape, if you're enthralled to the people who are organising it.
You didn't interrupt the other two guests. We see a lot of addiction on the streets. We see a lot of people homeless. If we're going to look at aggressive actions or radical actions, the police are not going to be able to solve that. What are they going to do? Put somebody in prison for them to be released back into homelessness the next week, or to be released out of a holding cell, back to no home, back to no life, back to no family? If we want to look at how we address this, we look at a task force that's multidisciplinary across departments. Everybody needs to be housed, which is an issue that we need to look at.
But do you find it acceptable, and as you seem to, that, you know, poor, unfortunate people with a bad lot in life are sitting in front of the monument to our freedom, the GPO, and people who go there to, you know, pay their respects to that building are intimidated?
Who's not free? The people that are paying their respects, or the person who feels that they have to sit and humiliate themselves in front of the GPO and beg. They're the ones that are not free. What type of freedom have we fought for then in terms of the GPO?
There's two questions here. I think that the state in general invests quite a lot in giving people other opportunities, be it through education, through supports and so on. And we need to make sure people can avail the opportunities. I accept, for whatever reason, some find that they can't find their way in that. And we need to do more in that space. But that's separate to people who choose to be involved in organised begging or criminal activities. That needs to be dealt with. But there has to be joined up thinking across all state agencies. I accept that. And generally, a task force brings the focus you need to have the intervention at all different levels. But we need to improve the situation, whichever way you come with this. And I think task force are the way to achieve that. But
this is not about perception. There's something much more fundamental here. But the thing about it is, this is a Garda initiative.
Yeah.
But there's something much wider needed. And there is no doubt that there is aggressive begging is an organised aggressive begging.
No, but it's also drug taking, drug dealing, visible to anyone who has eyes to see.
Well, I mean, we do have legislation for safe consumption rules.
But how do you deal with that if you don't deal with the addiction? And you've got to. I mean, you're just moving it around the place. So you have to deal with the addiction issue.
I mean, Giuliani cleaned up New York, but moved it to New Jersey and out to the burbs. That's what happened.
But just to be clear, some of the issues that cause concern and cause people to be afraid in our streets are nothing to do with poverty. They're to do with other aggressive behaviour. They're people who might be in jobs or well educated. So just to be clear, the task force is about bringing a focus to making our streets and our city centres a safer place in general. We're not picking on one group of people at all. It's a
but I think we are, Damien.
We shouldn't be. I mean, if we're talking
about people who are begging, people who are living in poverty, poverty doesn't manifest itself in nice ways. It manifests itself sometimes as people having to engage in criminality because they literally don't have opportunities available to them.
But to be clear, there's people involved in organised begging.
There are other people who do it for the crack.
Who does it for the crack?
They whack people on the back of the head for the crack.
Who does?
And they put it up on social media. I don't know who they are. I've never seen them apprehended. But people report what happened to them. They're walking along, whack, hit in the back of the head. Now, they're not being robbed. They're not. It's just pure devilment.
I live in Dublin City. I obviously have a different experience of my own city than other people do because I've never felt intimidated by anybody that needed support.
But the girl who ended up between the carriage and the platform. I mean, there was no financial gain. There was no poverty at play there. There was messing. That's what was at play there.
But the task force is not dealing with that. That's not what was set out here. What was set out was a scenario where tourists would be coming into the city. People are begging. There's drug use.
We're not only talking about tourists. We're talking about, and I could read the text we read out earlier, someone going to the Savoy last night and dozens of kind of antisocial, intimidating experiences on the way in and the way out of that cinema. Ordinary Irish people, not tourists.
But what are this got to do with people taking drugs in doorways? So we're mixing lots of different things up here. So we're putting the idea out that a task force and people are begging under GPOs and bank machines, and then we're also saying that people are using drugs in doorways.
But they're all different things. The combination makes O'Connell Street a deeply uncomfortable place.
I'm not uncomfortable on O'Connell Street.
It's not just O'Connell Street. There's no doubt there's an issue with drug addiction. There's no doubt there's an issue with homelessness, and there's no doubt there's an issue with poverty. You don't resolve those by just having a Garda-led initiative.
Exactly.
It has to be wider than that. Now, that's not to say that there isn't some value in this in its own right, but it will only be a stick and plaster if you don't deal with the other issues.
Because we all want the same thing. Nobody wants victims of crime. Right, so when I speak, nobody wants anybody to be a victim of crime. And to get to that, the place that we all want to be in, we need to make sure that people have different lives available to them. And I just go about that in a different way than policing.
I want to move on to something else. At a mass in the Stole on Sunday, Father Sean Sheehy said gay couples were sinful, criticised free contraception being provided by the HSE as it was promoting promiscuity. But here is the man himself, Father Sheehy, on News Talk earlier in the week.
Sin is in all kinds of forms. But the ones that are promoted, though, by the legislation and by the culture are specific to what I was saying. In other words, permission of abortion, that's sinful. That's killing the unborn. Transgenderism, that's going against the law of nature. It's going against the book of Genesis. You know, there are only two genders, and that's it. It's also It's also detrimental to children when we see the sex education program that's been introduced to the schools, which is actually taking the innocence of children away. That's all part of sinfulness. Of course, homelessness is too, and all the rest of it. I mean, sin comes in all kinds of forms, but the scriptures, though, today, or on Sunday, focused on, you know, what we need to be saved about. And those are the things that the Holy Spirit prompted me to speak about, and so I did. And that was my job, actually. And sadly, I didn't want to hurt anybody. It wasn't my intention.
So, scripted by the Holy Spirit, Catherine.
Yeah. Look, this is the kind of hellfire and brimstone type thing that we, that is very much in the past. I noted the bishop came out very swiftly and apologised. But the problem is that people have been very hurt by this. I don't know if I would describe it as a sermon, but people have been very hurt by it. And the thing about it is, you can't unhurt people by apologising. Mm. You know, and I think in many ways, Irish people have demonstrated where Ireland is at by, for example, how they voted in the past two referenda. But
there are people who kind of go along with his notion that if something is supposed to be wrong and is a sin under the Catholic teaching, well, then it's wrong, and kind of going softly on it is not the kind of church they want. But they're kind of, I don't know whether they're outnumbered because so few people are actually going to the churches these days.
Yeah, but you did see, for example, people standing up and walking out of that church, a sizable number. You wouldn't have maybe seen that 30 or 40 years ago.
They wouldn't stand up to the clergy.
They wouldn't. So I think that we're seeing a very different response, and rightly so.
Lynn? Yeah, I think what's important is, obviously, you know, he takes the scripture literally and this is what he believes. But what I thought was the more important story in all of this was that the Bishop of Kerry apologised about those remarks. And I think, isn't that a new Ireland where a bishop, and why aren't we having him on to talk about why he apologised for those remarks, why he felt that they weren't very Christian in a more modern Ireland? And I think that that's the story we should be looking at. We should be looking at those that...
You know, Father Sheehy would probably say, well, the bishop has, you know, lost his bottle, really, in terms of the rules of the church.
Yeah, or he's just moved on and doesn't take... You know, we have different levels of Christianity. We have, you know, the evangelicists. We have people that take it word for word for word with no new ones. But we've lots of Christians and lots of Catholics that can take scripture and take what feels real and what doesn't feel real. And I think we should be focused on the bishop's apology.
Yeah, I think I'll go along with Lynn. I'm glad the bishop came out swiftly on this and made it very clear that what Father
he didn't have to be forced to come out. He reacted very quickly.
Straight away. And I think the words he used were, it doesn't represent the Christian position.
Exactly.
And that, to me, is really, really clear. And that reflects the Pope's commentary and teaching on this space over the last number of years as well.
I mean, is it fair to paraphrase that the Catholic Church's message at the moment under this Pope particularly is, you love the sinner even if you don't love the sin.
Correct. And no one can judge who's going to hell or who's not. And the priest was completely out of order with that. So I'm glad the bishop has made that. His commentary goes back to an Ireland that we've all moved on from a long time ago, and rightly so. And we're much more, I'd say, open to proper conversation and dialogue, and it's appropriate how to do that.
Yeah, I just think in many ways I agree with Lynn, because you're amplifying the hurt by constantly, you know, giving this guy a platform, if you like. Yeah. And
but for many people, isn't he an object of derision?
Yeah,
almost.
But look, just think of your teenage youngster who's struggling with their sexuality, for example. Mm. What are they, you know, they're hearing this. Mm. You know, this is very damaging.
They're hearing him challenged all the time, though, in fairness. Yeah. Damien, I want to go back to you about Twitter. Did you get any notice of Twitter axing half the jobs?
Apart from following some of the commentary from himself over the last year or two, no, I'm not aware, because in our department we would get notifications. There's proper engagement rules there around a 30-day process, and I'm not certainly that on my desk nothing can be from Twitter. I don't need the tarnish to got it either.
So Elon did not communicate, and clearly he didn't communicate with anyone, even in California.
Not that I've got, Pat. That doesn't mean, and I've just checked before I come on to make sure I'm up to date on that, but I'm fairly sure I'm right on this
some
one.
Some of the poor unfortunates.
And to be clear, I mean, the labour laws in Ireland are very different to most countries. We've great protections here, and there's a process to go through if you they want to be kind of any redundancy. So two things here, seeing two different approaches, two different large companies, how they're approaching and respecting their staff over the last day or two. I'd be very concerned for those who might get that bad news today or getting blocked from their emails already. That's not a way to treat anybody.
Yeah. Now, and the minimum notice in strike, for example, would be 14 weeks. Now, they may not be at work, but they'll get 14 weeks redundancy pay.
There's a proper way to go through this. Now, thankfully, within the sector, there are vacancies, and in relation to Ireland, we've many job vacancies across many sectors because our eggs aren't all in one basket. But no one likes to get that news that their job is gone or going to be gone soon. It's not a nice position to be in. But we, you know, as a country, we're in a better place for employment than we would have been maybe 10 or 11 years ago. That's a positive. But this is not a way to do business at all for anybody, you know.
Yeah. Lynn?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to keep up at the minute. I think the Twitter situation is changing so quickly that it's really hard to follow. But I mean, it is worrying. I mean, workers in this current climate, like we're hearing so much fear around cost of living, around lots of different things. So to be able, you know, to be facing into potential unemployment at this time and in the way that it seems to be getting done, if it is, it's disgraceful.
We thought that some people in Northern Ireland might be facing unemployment or certainly a lack of paycheck. Those politicians elected to the Assembly, it looks like they'll hang on to their paychecks, Damien, for a little while longer.
It looks that way, and I'm glad that there's no election being announced just now. It doesn't mean that he's not going to get...
He's obliged to, legally.
Within 12 weeks. So the two options there are not to change the legislation or have an election. But I think what this does give us is at least a few more weeks, more time and space for conversations to continue. I think any of us around this table would agree politicians should be in the executive. It should be up and running. That's what we want. Yeah. It's always somebody's fault. There's always somebody's excuses, the different parties over the years. As far as I'm concerned, they should be in there at every opportunity, showing that democracy can work and can deliver.
And I think that's
not finding ways to be out of it.
I think it's important around democracy. I mean, we need to look at how disenfranchised people can get. And if you do believe in a democratic system and you're shown up time and time again to vote and pass your democratic right to vote, and then you don't see the end result ever of that vote, you push voters out of the system completely, and we need to make sure that that doesn't happen and make sure that the power sharing can actually work and that people can see a result.
Yeah. It's hard to see that, Catherine, any result being terribly different, even if they do have an election in the new year.
That is the concern for, you know, and for many of the people in the executive, but for the majority of them, I would say. But an election, all it would be to polarise the situation even further, unless something changes. And we need to see some very serious leadership from the Secretary of State and from the Conservative government.
But do you think he has a clue, basically? Because, you know, we were talking about this in the programme during the week.
I wondered.
They don't, the people in Northern Ireland don't know where their politicians are going. But maybe the British haven't enough real interest in this.
Yeah, and I think it's been like musical chairs with Secretary of States, which doesn't help because you're not building up trust among the various parties. It was interesting that he talked to them after he had put a deadline. And like he then engaged in,
well, he was using the brinksmanship at midnight Thursday. I'm going to call an election, and then he didn't.
But he misunderstands the DUP.
That he's prepared to stand back from his own commentary and say, look, give this more time. That's a positive. We shouldn't.
No, but what he demonstrated was that was a bluff. His midnight Thursday was a bluff, and now the next time he imposed a deadline, he'll be saying, "Actually, he's only caught."
Over the years of Northern Ireland politics, there's been plenty of these deadlines and midnights and so on. It's important that people in charge can give every opportunity and every time and space is needed. So to be able to come roll back from that, to me, I would see it as a positive, just to give us a few more weeks, and hopefully the politicians up there, you know, and I blame more than just one party, they need to put their heads together and get in working together as an executive, delivering for Northern Ireland at a difficult time for everybody. People have other cost of living crisis at the moment. They don't need this. They need the politicians doing their jobs.
I just think it's like, it's concerning that you would, like, when they came to the idea that you would have to set up, like, within 12 weeks there would have to be an election from the 28th of October. If they don't have an election within that and they move to change the amount of time, it's like these figures are arbitrary. There must have been a huge amount of discussion in that legislation as to why that 12 weeks was important and what that meant. So I think, like, even though nothing might change, they do need to stick to their legislation or give a very good reason as to why they would extend that election time.
Finally, the fact that the UK is heading into a 2-year recession is what they're predicting. And yet, nobody is kind of admitting that Brexit is at the heart of all their difficulties, or most of their difficulties.
I agree.
Extraordinary.
Yeah.
Dishonesty at the highest level.
I think you're right, Pat. And I remember the comment was made years ago, Brexit is forever. It's not just a one-year impact. The impacts of Brexit have probably been hidden because of COVID in the UK. We know the effects it's had here. We managed to trade through a lot of that and our economy is not going into recession. But the UK, and you're right, they're in difficulty and Brexit is part of that. But also, you know, the constant change in your government, the lack of decision-making and clear direction. Yeah. And
Northern Ireland was an afterthought. I mean, right through that Brexit debate, and this is the fallout from that. But also,
come back into the single market, negotiate your way back in. Mm. The protocol is solved, and on we go. But they're not going to do that.
But even without that, the protocol can be made work better. And the EU are willing to are very flexible on that. As an Irish government, we've been very flexible working on that as well. There's plenty of opportunity for that protocol to work, and it was agreed by the UK government with the support of the unionists. It was agreed with the EU, but there's flexibility in that, and we're all willing to do that. But to do that, you have to talk about it and work it through.
It'd be interesting to see how the Conservatives...
Happy to leave it to them.
Yeah, I'm happy.
All right, we have to leave it there. Catherine Murphy, Social Democrats, TD for Kildare, co-leader of her party. Damien English, Fine Gael, TD for Meath West, and Minister of State for Business, Employment and Retail. And Lynn Rowan, Trinity College Independent Senator. Thank you all very much.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.